Welcome to the Azure Security Podcast, where we discuss topics relating to security, privacy, reliability, and compliance on the Microsoft Cloud Platform.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 118. This week is myself, Michael, with Mark Simos, and our guest this week is another Mark, Mark Rasinovich. Mark, I don't think needs any introduction whatsoever, but Mark, welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to spend just a moment and introduce yourself to our listeners.
Sure. Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me on. I'm the Chief Technology Officer of Azure. I'm also a technical fellow at Microsoft. And as of about a year and a half ago, I've got some additional titles, Deputy CISO for Azure, Deputy CISO for Engineering Systems, and for our core operating systems, Linux and Windows.
So actually, before we get on, what is a technical fellow? I'm sure a lot of our listeners would like to know.
Well, that's a great question. In fact, Scott Hanselman and I just recorded on our Scott and Mark Learn To podcast an episode on career trajectories for developers at Microsoft, where we do discuss in some depth about what the distinguished titles of distinguished engineer and technical fellow mean. But in a nutshell, it means that the engineer at Microsoft has had massive impact on the company and likely the industry in whatever domain that they happen to be working in as an individual innovator.
Yeah, a good friend of mine over in Azure Data just became distinguished engineer. So it's great to see.
Yeah, it's an impressive accomplishment to get that, because it's also typically means that you've been executing at that level for a long time to be able to have that kind of impact.
Yeah. All right. So let's get stuck into the topic of this, which is all about quantum cryptography, basically a podcast based on a blog post that you wrote. We just want to turn it into sort of an audio format for people who want to sort of learn more about this while they're driving to the gym or something. So let's get stuck into something. I've got the intros out the way.
My first question is, you know, if you could kind of give your take on quantum, right? And, you know, because there's quantum computing, there's quantum physics, there's quantum cryptography. So if you kind of, you know, give us a quick sense of that, and then very interested in this term quantum safe, like what does that mean, you know, to us, to Microsoft, to you? And, you know, why is that, you know, becoming a big deal for people?
Sure. So in this context, we're talking about quantum computing, which is computing that takes advantages of quantum physics. If you take a look at classical computing, it's very much binary, and it starts with transistors that have on and off states. When you talk about quantum computing, you're talking about the quantum effects at microscopic level, different materials that actually live in a superposition state, which means that they actually reflect a probability of a state that doesn't reflect an actual state until you measure it. And this is kind of the bizarre thing about quantum physics. When I started to look more closely at quantum physics, which I'd never had any education on in high school or college, about 10 years ago, as I got more familiar with the quantum program that we had, my mind was blown by some of the effects of quantum physics, like the double slit experiment with light, for example, where you shine the light through the double slits, and if you're measuring the number of photons going through, you actually end up with a pattern on the wall or the reader on the other side of the slits that shows that the photons went through one slit or another. But if you don't measure them, then you end up with a scatter that shows that they actually kind of went through both slits. And that's just we're not used to thinking about things like that. What this allows you to do is computations that work on maintaining massive amounts of state in a very compact way. Because if you wanted to simulate a physical environment like that light going through the slits with a classical computer, basically you have to represent for each bit has two to that power of bits of state represented in it, that in a quantum bit can store all of that state in just that one bit. Simulating a quantum computer is exponential in a classical system. And if you want to simulate 100 atoms, now you're talking about 2^100 states. And you start to explode in terms of memory, for one thing. Whereas in a quantum computer, you're just talking about 100 qubits. And what you can do with qubits is actually simulate physical environments. Like Feynman said, quantum computing, which he's one of the pioneers of quantum computing, is the best way to simulate a physical system is with the physical system itself, something that represents it. And the physical world is quantum and probabilistic. And so if you can simulate it with probabilistic computing, you can actually simulate exact outcomes. And where this becomes interesting is when you want to solve problems like, how do these molecules bond? How do I develop a new chemical that has these properties? How do I simulate traffic, which has actually this kind of exponential state thing, and best and optimal traffic flows? And you can look at problems around different domains and see where using this kind of power would help you solve problems that are intractable on quantum on classical computers. So back in the early 2000s, around 2008, Microsoft embarked on a quantum computing program to build a quantum computer. And the key part of a quantum computer is the qubit that you pick, the physical qubit you pick. Which material are you going to use that has that quantum physical property to build your quantum computer on top of? And there's lots of different microscopic materials that exhibit these quantum physical properties. Like, you can take an atom itself, you can take an electron, you can take a photon, you can take ions, and you can use them as your physical qubit. Now, the pros and cons of using different physical qubits is they each have different sizes and speeds and stability. And so kind of those three dimensions. And back in 2008, Microsoft quantum researchers concluded that all of the kind of materials that I just mentioned, or physical qubits I just mentioned, were not going to get us onto a path to a scalable quantum computer. And I'll describe what that is in a second. But they'd read about this, or knew about this theoretical particle called a Majorana fermion, which was actually predicted by Enrico Majorana, Italian physicist, back in the, I think it was the 1930s. But nobody had ever actually seen one. And they said, well, this particle, which is its own antiparticle, if it exists, is fast, small, and stable. And if we could build a quantum computer with this, we could get to scale of a million qubits on a wafer of material that you could actually produce. And the benefit of that over looking at some of these other physical qubits like transmons or ions or photons or electrons is that with all those other technologies, you have to create a system that has a million logical qubits or a few hundred thousand logical qubits. You're talking about a system that is the size of a conference room or larger. And with that comes this big problem of, how do I synchronize the thing across that kind of scale? And how do I measure things reliably? And how do I keep everything coherent? And this is what it's called. You don't want the superimposed state to collapse. You want it to stay in that state. Once you measure it, of course, it collapses. And you can inadvertently get measurements which cause it to collapse. So the bigger your system, the more likely you're going to have collapse. And then that means the more error correction you need, which means the system gets even bigger. But with Majorana fermions, we could avoid all that. And so that's been the focus of the program since the start, is how do we actually prove these things exist? Then how do we make them reliably? And then how do we build a qubit on top of it? And then how do we build a quantum gate on top of that? And we've been hitting each one of those one after the other steps on the path to Majorana fermion based system. These are called topological qubits, the ones we build with Majorana fermions. And I think it was like 6 or 7 years ago, we proved that they exist. And there was a paper in Nature. Microsoft proves that Majorana fermions do exist. And then the next paper was Microsoft proves that they can make them. And now we actually showed what we can create qubits on top of them. And then at Build, we announced Majorana 1, which is an 8-bit topological qubit based system. That's our first one to actually start playing with and investigating the properties of it. And then the path is, of course, to scale that into hundreds of thousands onto a single wafer. Mm-hmm. And then we've been building all the supporting infrastructure around having a real scalable quantum computer when it's ready, like SDKs for how you program the quantum computer, getting the algorithms ready so when it's ready, it's ready, getting cryogenic CMOS controllers that we can put next to the quantum computer so that we can actually measure and control it at scale without worrying about the decoherence.
Like, this essentially allows you to do calculations that were extremely difficult before, which is essentially what our cryptography was built on, very quickly, right?
And so exactly.
Quantum computing is great on one hand, and then it's terrible for security on the other hand.
You're right. So we're creating this situation where with a scalable quantum computer of a few hundred thousand qubits, you can start to break elliptical curve cryptography and RSA cryptography. At the key lengths that we're using today. you know, 256-bit keys would be breakable by a system of that size. And that poses, obviously, this existential threat to computer security, because if somebody can break that, the TLS isn't secure, on disk encryption isn't secure because the keys themselves are encrypted that way, and then ultimately there's symmetric cryptography.
Almost every technical control relies on cryptography in some form or fashion. Without that,
You know, hashing is control, hashing gets broken. Like all the fundamentals of our computer security are broken once that.
Yeah, and isn't there a thing right now where people are actually collecting ciphertext? They can't break it yet.
This is a break now, read later, or decrypt later,
they're grabbing it now and they're going to do it later.
harvest now, decrypt later.
Yeah, HNDL, like handle. Yeah,
and that if you can read the TLS, you can just record the TLS communication, the handshake, and then break it with a quantum computer at some point, and then all that communication is in the clear.
Yeah, very cool. Well, not very cool at all, but anyway.
Very scary, actually.
Yeah. So what are the biggest challenges, biggest technical challenges with migrating to post-quantum cryptography that you see? Like, people need to really, really think about? I mean, what does ASIO need to think about, for example?
Well, so the first thing is what kind of timeline that we've got for this. Because I think that's, you know, you need to do a work back, which is what we've done, which is saying, when do we think we'll get to that kind of scale? Or somebody will. And we think Microsoft has a good chance of getting there first. And we think that in the early 2030s might be the kind of time frame we're talking about for a scalable quantum computer to be in the hands of people that want to break cryptography. And so when we work back from that, we say, what's the timeline we need to be ready to safely ready, conservatively ready for that? And so we set ourselves a timeline of 2029. And that means, and being quote post-quantum safe means we've actually switched over to using cryptographic algorithms that quantum computers can't break, instead of using these ones that I mentioned. And that means starting with the core dependencies of, like, your cryptographic library support it, and then your chips in the operating system, and then your network traffic TLS is starting to use it, and your on-disk key protection and wrapping and your token signing are all using those kinds of algorithms. And so we've mapped out all the steps we need to take, starting with the fundamental one of, hey, let's get those algorithms coded up and included in our crypto libraries, and then going from there. And so quantum safe means you've actually re-encrypted your keys. You've actually switched over to that for all your network communications as well. And you're signing all your code with those algorithms as well.
So the tool that we have started working on, one of those fundamental components is SimCrypt, right?
Yep.
Which is available, it's up on GitHub for Windows and Linux, and I assume Mac as well, is that?
Yeah, it is is there for Mac too.
So where does SimCrypt fit in the hierarchy? So Windows today, we've historically had Crypto API and then CNG, Crypto Next Generation. So where does SimCrypt map in that hierarchy? And when are protocols like TLS 1.x or 2.x, whatever happens in the future, going to switch over to using these post-quantum algorithms?
So it's like the most fundamental piece. It's at the heart, the bottom of the dependency stack is SimCrypt. And so that's where we started first. And we've got two algorithms, post-quantum algorithms, shipping as part of SimCrypt, MLDSA and MLChem. So DSA is digital signatures and Chem is key exchange. And those are NIST certified official standards for post-quantum cryptographic algorithms. One of the challenges, by the way, we faced is that these algorithms are showing up. They go through, we're waiting for NIST approval. And the risk here, even as the algorithms get approved, and that means cryptographers have beaten on this in the public for a few years and nobody's found any flaws with them, is that actually even the ones that got through the initial NIST gates, some of them have fallen by the wayside as researchers find problems with them. And we don't know for sure that there's not going to be problems found with these. This is such a complex mathematical space, like, I'm not an expert in it. I don't know if you are, Michael, but we run this risk. And so we got to be quantum crypto agile. And crypto agility now means, hey, if something happens to MLDSA, we need to be able to swap it out for another one.
So crypto agility is one of my favorite topics. Yeah. Favorite topics. The biggest mistake I find people make, you know, both inside Microsoft, to be honest, and outside of Microsoft, is to hard code / embed crypto algorithm information. So, for example, I've actually seen code from a customer, believe it or not, that was using 56-bit DAS, ECB, electronic code book, right? So you can imagine how weak that is. But they had terabytes of data encrypted with it, and they couldn't do anything about it, you know, easily, because their code just was hard-coded to use DAS, electronic code book. So I don't know. I can certainly talk at length about practical ways that we've done crypto agility inside of Microsoft. Is there anything you want to talk about? Because I do want to spend like probably 60 seconds just to give people some flavor about what crypto agility actually means from a practical perspective.
I mean, I think you should run with it.
Okay. Again, it's one of my pet topics. I'm just a huge fan. In fact, in the Microsoft security development lifecycle, it's also a requirement, you know, thou shalt be crypto agile. So what does that actually mean? Well, it basically means that you can change algorithms and aspects of algorithms on the fly. So you could change from AES to a post-quantum algorithm. You could change from, let's say you're still using AES, but you want to go from, I don't know, cipher blockchaining to Galois counter mode. You can easily do that. And the way you do it is essentially, there's two major ways of doing it. One of them is the way SQL Server does it with Always Encrypted. When they encrypt the data, they use AES 256 with a SHA-256 HMAC. And that is version one. Now, if they decided to move to some other algorithm, say post-quantum or perhaps Galois counter mode or whatever, right? That could be version two. And so the first byte of the ciphertext is the version number. And then their code, they just look at what it is and they encrypt and decrypt using that. The nice thing about that is new stuff can be encrypted with version two and they can read the old stuff, right? Which is version one, which is really, really nice. Mm-hmm. The other way that's commonly used is in Microsoft Office in their XML data format. They have an XML block at the very beginning, which describes all the cipher information that's used in that document. So, you know, it could be AES in cipher blockchaining mode, 256. Here's the initialization vector, password-based key derivation function for deriving the key based on the password, whatever. I don't know, right? All that sort of stuff is in there. The nice thing about that is, again, you can read it.
Yeah.
In whatever format it is, and you can write it out with whatever is the current version. I don't think Office exposes, you know, the individual knobs that you can tweak on the cryptography, but internally it certainly could. And those are two magnificent ways of supporting crypto agility, because it allows you to read the old data encrypted in the old cruddy format and write out using the latest and greatest. To your point, Mark, you know, let's say one of these new algorithms has an issue in it, and so version two is released, then you can upgrade to version two and still read the old data and then write out using the newer format if you propose that you should do that.
Now, speaking of formats, I think one of the things that as part of this transition is that we can't just flip over to post-quantum cryptography. We've got to be compatible with existing systems. And so we have now hybrid TLS connections, for example, which will use both. So if we find that when we're ready to flip, we can flip over. It also means we can fall back to the classical ones if there's a problem with the quantum safe ones or the supposedly quantum safe ones.
Yeah. So does TLS 1.3 today have reserved cipher suites for post-quantum, or is that something that's still evolving?
Because that's where we're doing it with TLS 1.3.
Okay. Very cool. That's really, really cool. Yeah. And actually, so TLS has historically also supported crypto agility, right? Because during the negotiation, you negotiate, like, here's the cipher suites that I support as the server, and here's the cipher suites that I support as the client, and the server selects the strongest out of the intersection of the two. And if there is no intersection, then there's no communication, right? Because we can't agree on the algorithm. So TLS has always done a very good job on crypto agility as well.
In this case, it's encrypted with both algorithms. So if one breaks, the other is still protected by the other one if the other one's secure.
When you say it's encrypted, you mean the keys are encrypted?
The key, right? The symmetric keys that are exchanged. Yeah.
Just stepping back for a moment, just I want to make sure that this is clear to the audience. Like, we're talking about crypto agility in the context of Microsoft, right? And, you know, the protocols and whatnot. But the reality is it's not just, hey, we've got Azure and then we get a new algorithms from Microsoft through Windows Update and the other mechanisms. And it's, you know, there's a certain amount that's kind of done for you. But there's a lot of stuff that uses cryptography, you know, different physical devices, whether IoT, OT, you know, older software, might be hard-coded stuff, maybe custom built, maybe a vendor's out of business, et cetera. And so organizations really need to start thinking through, how do we do inventory of all of the different crypto algorithms we have, you know, via software, via hardware, or, you know, essentially software embedded in hardware. And really starts thinking about that, because that's the key challenge of quantum is, you know, there may be some devices that you simply can't update the crypto algorithms for. So definitely start that conversation, that thinking early, because you do not want to be caught flat-footed trying to buy new devices when, you know, it's sort of like I live in Florida, so it's like toilet paper in a hurricane. You don't want to be trying to buy the same thing everybody else is all at the same time, because there's only going to be so many replacement devices and whatnot.
You bring up a good point around hardware, because that's what everybody's recognized we need to be on top of right away. And in fact, at Microsoft, we pioneered and launched with a group of partners, AMD and NVIDIA, Google, and others, an open source root of trust for our data center hardware. And root of trust is the core component that launches the whole platform and does the measurement and the attestation for the security posture of the platform. If that thing is broken, then you have no security in hardware. And even your software systems on top rely on that. And so this core root of trust called Calyptra now has in Calyptra 2.0, this Adams Bridge accelerator is a component of it, which is a post-quantum safe cryptographic accelerator to support the post-quantum algorithms on part of that root of trust. And so that is part of OCP, the Open Compute Project. Anybody can take and use it. All of our hardware that we're building in ourselves in Azure uses Calyptra. And like I mentioned, some of those partners and a broader hardware ecosystem are now using Calyptra as well. Because it takes, from the time you put it in your design, 3 years effectively till it shows up in production hardware.
Cool. Now, you'd mentioned a little bit of work with NIST. Can you talk a little bit more about, in general, how we work with standards bodies like NIST, ISO, and the like on this topic, and how we're sort of contributing in those ways, in addition to the open source stuff you mentioned?
Sure. Well, the standards are extremely important, right? The standards bodies are defining for governments what crypto algorithms they consider secure. And ideally, you know, we settle just like we have with classical crypto on some standards for the whole world, for the whole industry. In the case of the post-quantum algorithms, NIST took a lead on this. And they had, in 2017, they had a call for submissions for post-quantum safe algorithms for these various operations like digital signatures and key exchange. And Microsoft actually submitted 4 submissions. So these are 4 algorithms that our security or cryptographic researchers came up with into that call. And I think there's one in the current one. So we've been hard at work at coming up with crypto algorithms that look like they'll be post-quantum safe and submitting them to NIST. And so we're working with other standardization bodies, ISO and ITF, again, on defining the standards for what does hybrid key exchange look like for TLS 1.3, as well as whatever those standards bodies are defining as requirements around cryptography, that we make sure that post-quantum is reflected there.
So at a practical perspective, I mean, what impact is this going to have on Azure, Windows, Office, and so on? I mean, will people actually see any real changes, or do we expect to see sort of perhaps UI changes or configuration changes? Or do we expect this to be pretty much hidden from most end users?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. And I think our goal is to make it hidden from everybody. Anybody that doesn't need to know about it shouldn't have to worry about it. It should just be there baked in. Like, I think most people aren't even aware of, you know, the classical cryptography algorithms that we're using. The vast majority of people, right? It's just typically a few people that are worried about crypto,
yeah,
that are looking and saying, oh, time to upgrade our, you know, retire TLS 1.2 and time to retire this algorithm. Time to move from MD5 to secure hashing, right? And most people don't even know what MD5 is, so.
Yeah, so you're telling me people don't need to learn quantum superposition?
Yeah, that's
okay,
right.
That's good. That's a good thing. That's a really good thing. Yeah, okay. Exactly. So put your philosophical hat on, your technical philosophical hat. And I know you're actually very good at this. I actually enjoy listening to you when you talk about things like this. But where do you see like the intersection? We live in really amazing times, right? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, everyone's had to learn about AI. Whether you wanted to or not, you've now, you know, if you're a nerd, you've got to learn about AI, right? You just have to. And I see that on the horizon as well with quantum. All of a sudden, people are learning about superposition and all sorts of things like that. Where do you see that intersection in the future, say 20 years from now, where intersection of like AI and security and quantum and massive compute in the cloud and massive storage, where do we see that going for, you know, in the future?
Yeah. Well, so first, I think the reason a lot of people are talking about quantum and post-quantum cryptography today is because they're worried about it, not because they need to know about it. Like if we could do this transparently, like we talked about, the problem solved, they're not going to talk about it. When it talks about quantum computers, the only people that are going to be looking at quantum computers are the people writing quantum algorithms. If you think about a quantum computer, it's not a compute, it's not a replacement for a classical computer. You should think of it as an accelerator. And just like very few people write CUDA kernels for GPUs, very few people are going to be writing quantum algorithms for quantum computers. And most cases, and there's very few applications, you know, the kind of specialized ones I talked about, like chemical simulation and new molecule discovery. Those kinds of applications are going to be the only ones that care about quantum accelerators. So the vast majority of people will continue about their AI-related business without even thinking about quantum computing or quantum cryptography. But where it is applied, it can have a huge impact. Like we can come up with artificial fertilizer and carbon capture molecules that allow us to reverse greenhouse gas effects in our atmosphere and come up with new chemicals that have really cool properties very efficiently.
Wasn't there something just recently we did with Pacific Northwest Labs with like a lithium battery?
Yeah, a new type of battery that was...
Yeah.
So, yeah, one of the things that we ask all of our guests is, you know, what does a day in the life look like for Mark Rusinovich? That's always sort of a, you know, we ask of all of our guests, but, you know, in particular, you know, everybody knows your SysInternals history and, you know, the deputy CISO role and all the cool stuff that you do and share with Scott. But like, what's a day in the life look like for you?
It depends on the day. It's very, like every day is a new adventure. I'd say if you said the average of all my days is 80% meetings, and those meetings are divided into meetings with my team to do checkpoints and reviews on the work we're doing, meetings that are broader architectural, typically meetings across Azure, one-on-ones with key technical leaders across Azure and other parts of the company. Outside of the meetings, then it's reading papers, internal papers, it's reading external papers, it's looking at what's going on with technology, and it's also playing with AI. I'm spending a lot of time just in between meetings and in evenings and weekends researching, doing AI research and researching AI.
So I want to just pull on that thread just a little bit. Yeah. I'm a big fan of like just constant learning. You got to do it, right? You can't just ignore things. So what's your little strategies for learning things?
My father actually gave me some advice when I was growing up. He's like, when you want to learn a new subject, go find the thinnest book you can on it. And I was like, that's really sunk in over time. I know what he's saying. It's basically like, go read the most high-level description of the subject, because that'll give you an overview, and then you can dive in from there.
I'm a huge fan of that. I actually, of that concept, not the thin book, that's a new one on me.
Yeah.
But just the whole, get an idea of what the thing is. Because obviously, sometimes you just don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And so getting an idea of what the thing is, now you've got an idea of the things you probably should understand, and then go a bit deeper from that point forward. And in fact, if you follow your dad's wisdom, if you think about it, I've heard many, many years ago someone say, if you are a technical person and you can't explain something simply...
Richard Feynman.
Was it Feynman? That's right. It was Feynman who said that. A person said that. Okay, Feynman said that. If you can't explain it simply, then you probably don't really understand the topic that well.
Yeah, kind of coincidentally, since we've been talking about quantum computing, and he's the father of quantum computing.
Yeah, it is kind of, yeah. That's why I asked the question, Mark. You knew that.
Yeah. I love that, you know, read the thinnest book thing. Cause like, I used to like worry, cause I have a lot of books, right? And people see the bookshelf behind me oftentimes, the videos. And I sometimes only make it to chapter like 2 or 3. And I used to feel guilty about that. Like, oh, I had to learn everything technically. But if I can get the gist of it and the idea of it in the first couple of chapters, I don't necessarily need to know the 10x level of detail on
it. Yeah, and that you can decide if you want to because you need to or because you're interested. So for the other thing that I do is get hands-on. Like if you really want to understand something, you need to actually, in the world of code, of course, it's like go code it or go use the product. You want to go a level deeper, go write about it. So actually the Windows Internals books that I worked on, that was one of my favorite activities, is one that has multiple benefits. And writing about something both forces you to learn and understand it to the point you can explain it like we just talked about. Also gets your name out there, like, and helps other people understand it.
I remember when I was working on designing, developing secure ASI solutions, it was when the hardware security modules, like the original managed HSMs, were coming on stream in Azure. The team was kind enough to give me access to one while I was writing the book. And it was interesting because I found issues in the SDK because I was tinkering in certain areas that you might not normally tinker in. Don't get me wrong, there weren't massive serious issues, but there were many documentation problems. But even so, you find issues while you're learning.
Yeah.
You know, and also the managed HSM support symmetric encryption, not just asymmetric encryption. And that leads to all sorts of different things you need to think about. So yeah, I agree, writing about something really forces you to think about what you're working on, and you learn a lot when you start writing about it. That's why I urge people, write blog posts. Like, if you've got like a topic of something, write a blog post on it. People will read it. Well, you'd be surprised.
Something I'm wondering, that the problem we're going to run into now is it's so easy to have AI write your blog post for you. If you rely on AI to do the writing, you're not going to get that kind of, I need to deep conceptualize this thing, understand it in a way that I can express it. You short circuit that, which I think is a risk to people really learning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm always very careful because, like, I have the same effect when I build a PowerPoint slide. I know people make fun of me for, you know, saying PowerPoint slides are a serious thing, but when you're actually trying to model the thing out and make something make sense, you find gaps visually too.
Yeah.
But like, I'm always very careful about how I use AI because I want to tap the power of it and the knowledge. Like, you know, we're doing roles and responsibility for security. So tell me what a CFO does for a living, and then I'll tell you what they can do, what they have to do for security to integrate it into their job, right? Or a COO or lawyers or whatever. And so it's great for tapping into things I don't know, but I always want to make sure that I'm doing some original thinking of my own on it, that I don't want to just take it as a final product and do a couple tweaks and minor like copy edit things, right? Like, I want to make sure I'm actually processing it.
Yeah.
All right, let's start to bring this episode to an end. So another question we ask our guests, Mark, is if you had just one final thought to leave our listeners with, what would it be?
Breathe.
Yeah. Breathe? That would be the shortest
I can explain
final
what I mean
thought
there.
Ever.
Like, it's stressful times. Stressful times in technology, stressful times in the world. And actually, one of the things that I discovered was mindfulness, which is effectively learning how to breathe and focus on breathing as a way to relieve stress and kind of ground yourself. I know it's not technical, but it helps in everything you do, whether it's technical or not. So that's what I'd leave people with. If you said one thing, you didn't scope it. So that's the thing.
No, and it's not scoped on purpose, right? We just want people to be really honest. And I'll be frank, we've never had anything even close to that. Everyone's given purely technical advice. So I think it's good to have something that's a bit more grounded.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. All right. So let's bring this episode to an end. Again, Mark, thank you. I know you're a really, really busy guy, so I really appreciate you taking the time, and Mark does too.
No, thanks. Fun conversation. Fun to talk to people like yourself, you and Mark, that know that you're living what I'm talking, and so we can have a great conversation.
You bet. Absolutely. That's 100% true. 100% true. All right. So again, thank you so much for joining us. And to all our listeners out there, we hope you found this episode interesting. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Azure Security Podcast. You can find show notes and other resources at our website, azsecuritypodcast.net. If you have any questions, please find us on Twitter at @AzureSecPod. Background music is from ccmixter.com and licensed under the Creative Commons license.